Welcome to Morgan Lewis Podcast Central. This is a podcast recording from Morgan Lewis's May 1st, 2014 7th Annual Conference, Advanced Topics in Hedge Fund Practices. Morgan Lewis partners Jed Wider and Timothy Levin chaired this 12-part in-depth discussion of U.S. and international advanced hedge fund topics focusing on manager and investor perspectives. Part 1. Mary Jo Gillette and Ivan Harris will discuss current and important SEC enforcement trends and issues in the hedge fund industry. Now, on to the podcast.
Mary Jo and I are here to talk about the SEC enforcement environment with respect to private funds. It has not exactly been a banner year for the SEC in terms of hedge fund enforcement activity. In fact, some of the most significant cases we'll be talking about today are cases that were a couple of years old and were resolved this year as opposed to brought this year. And the next panel with Jen Klass and Tim Levin talking about some of the exam priorities, that's really where a lot of the activity is taking place in the private fund space. So between these two panels, we'll hopefully give you all a good picture of where the SEC is currently thinking in its enforcement and examination program with respect to private funds, some of the things that they are starting to express disfavor for in the private fund space, and some of the hot button issues that you all should be looking out for in your everyday positions. Mary Jo is going to start off by talking about some of the latest enforcement statistics and priorities and new initiatives. Then we'll walk through some of the cases from the last couple of years. With that, we will turn it over to Mary Jo.
Good morning. As Ivan said, a lot of the important new initiatives and really ramping up in terms of allocation of resources, particularly in the private fund and private equity space, has really been happening during the last year and currently in the examination program. And I'm just going to touch on one thing. You'll hear a little bit more about this from the next panel, so I'm not going to go into a lot of detail, but I thought it was important to mention, and part of the importance of understanding what's happening in the examination program is that that really is almost always sort of a first step in what eventually, as issues become identified and the SEC develops its concerns in cases, eventually making it over into enforcement and becoming enforcement cases. That's not to say every exam becomes an enforcement case, so please don't hear my words to say that. The thing I wanted to mention is something that the SEC, an initiative that they have this year called Never Been Previously Examined Firms. And this is partially driven by the fact that the SEC's exam program now is risk-based, and therefore they select the registrants that they are going to examine based on a number of risk factors. For firms that they have never examined in the past and about which they know very little, it's very difficult for them to develop any kind of appropriate risk rating. And so this initiative is intended to get into as many of those advisors in particular that they can, including new private fund advisors. And that is specifically one of the groups that they are looking to examine. I'm going to shift now and just talk generally about the enforcement program at the SEC and some of the changes that have occurred recently and things that I think you ought to be aware of. Just to give you some context, in the last fiscal year, so the SEC's fiscal year ends on September 30th, the SEC brought 686 new enforcement matters. Of that, approximately 140 they announce as new cases in the 40 Act space, which basically comprises against advisors, investment companies or funds, and individuals associated with those entities. The overall number is down from the prior year. The number reported in the advisor and fund space is about the same as last year, but it's a little bit misleading. There are a number of what the SEC calls follow-on administrative proceedings that got pushed into that number to make it appear higher than it otherwise would have if they only, and there's nothing improper about them doing that, but I just want you to understand that those were not all new actions by the SEC. In terms of the activity in enforcement, the activity level, although the numbers were down last year, they appear to have a very strong pipeline for 2014. There were 908 new investigations opened in their fiscal 2013. They reported that they had slightly over 1,400 active and ongoing investigations. This is across all topic areas, not just in the advisor and fund space. They had or issued almost 600 formal orders of investigation, which was a 20% increase over the prior year. The formal order of investigation is the formal document that empowers the staff to issue subpoenas in the context of an enforcement investigation. So it's a good marker for the number of new matters that are fairly serious, because they do also have authority to look at things on an informal basis without subpoena power. And that just gives you a little bit of context for numbers. One of the other areas that continues to be a source of cases for the SEC is through its whistleblower program. As I'm sure all of you are aware, Dodd-Frank created a whistleblower program at the SEC, directed the agency to stand up something called the Office of the Whistleblower, and Congress separately appropriated a fund that whistleblowers were eligible to recover from if they provided the agency with information that led to an enforcement matter. I mean, that's an oversimplification. There are some criteria that have to be met there. Just because you provide information to the agency doesn't mean that you're going to be eligible for a whistleblower bounty. But the incentive is out there. And not only is it an incentive to employees, but there's really a whole cottage industry that's been developing of law firms that really specialize in this and seek out employees who might have information that would be appropriate for whistleblowers. The program's only been in place for 3 years. As of the end of last year, they reported that they had received over 3,200 tips, complaints, and referrals, which was about an 8% increase over the prior year. They have publicly announced that they have received these tips from all 50 states, from all of the U.S. territories, from 55 non-U.S. countries, with the largest number coming from the U.K., Canada, and China. So far, they do provide information publicly about the subject areas that the tips come in on, although these are very, very broad categories. The three that they have gotten the most tips in relate to financial fraud, offering fraud, and market manipulation. But I just want to caution you that each of those three categories sit right around 17%. So even those numbers are not tremendously high, and they have reported that they're getting information sent into them or brought into them in all of the areas that the SEC investigates in. Just to give you a little idea of what they've paid out so far, at the end of the last fiscal year, they had paid out a total of $14.8 million in bounties to whistleblowers, but $14 million of that was paid to a single whistleblower on the final day of the fiscal year. So the number's a little bit misleading. Since then, they have paid out two more whistleblower awards in their fiscal 2014, and they have been relatively small amounts. The whistleblowers are entitled to remain anonymous, and most elect to do so, and so we don't really have much more information other than what the SEC puts out in its report about the specifics of who these folks were and what the types of cases were that resulted from their tips. But just be aware that that's out there, and it's a channel that the SEC is continuing to develop and mine and use as a source for opening enforcement investigations. There have been a number of changes at the SEC in the last year, starting with the chairman changing to Mary Jo White, and every single division director has now been replaced, as well as 5 of the 11 regional directors in the regional offices around the country. So there's been significant change at the top. And we have seen that result in a number of new policies and initiatives. Probably the one that's gotten the most press is the new no admit, no deny policy. So historically, you were able to respond to and settle an SEC enforcement action by consenting to the entry of negotiated sanctions against you without admitting or denying the allegations that the agency made against you. In January of 2012, Rob Kazami, who was then the director of the Division of Enforcement, moved the policy slightly. And he, at that point, announced that in those cases where there was a parallel criminal investigation and there had been either a guilty plea or a conviction in the criminal setting, the SEC would now require admissions to also settle the civil charges with the SEC. Last summer, Mary Jo White announced that they were going significantly further and that in certain instances, not in every case, the SEC would require an admission of liability by the alleged wrongdoer as a condition of settlement. This is fairly controversial. It's a huge sea change from the way the agency interfaced with the public and with the industry historically. And it's particularly interesting for entities, financial services entities that are regulated by the SEC, because sort of the old lore was that you really didn't want to go to war, meaning into full-blown litigation, with your primary regulator. And you, if you look historically, a very high percentage of those cases settled. And it now has sort of reframed the cost-benefit analysis for firms who find themselves in that situation. And it's something to keep your eye on. There have only been 6 instances so far where the SEC has required admissions since the policy was announced. And about half of those have involved registered entities, maybe more than half, actually. Because there can be so much at stake for a firm if they move to admission or have to admit in order to settle with the regulator, I think that it's likely that you're going to see more cases going all the way to trial. And a very pragmatic limiter for the SEC on this is their limited resources. They have very few resources to really take a significant number of matters to trial. That's without even getting to what their success record is at trial when they actually do that. It will be very interesting to see going forward whether the pragmatic impact of the limited resources actually ends up limiting the scenarios in which they actually demand admissions. I think other open questions that we'll have to keep our eye on are whether, in a case that may have multiple defendants in it, is the way in which the agency treats the admissions issue going to be consistent for all actors within a given case? If someone settles early and they make an admission, will the agency then look for admissions for all those that come afterwards? Or will they try to calibrate it to what they believe to be the level of culpability within the overall case? Again, stay tuned on that.
And this is very evolving still. And if you've been involved in negotiations with the Division of Enforcement, as Mary Jo and I, or at least as I have, Mary Jo is still in her, 1 year, 2 year, 1 year, that she can't directly communicate, but indirectly involved. And if you've read the actual settlements that have been involved that have included admissions, the SEC demands that you admit the facts and acknowledge, but not admit, acknowledge that those facts constituted violations of the federal securities laws. And they will tell you in these discussions and negotiations that it's their view that an acknowledgement is different from an admission, and that another litigant cannot use that acknowledgement to preclude you from relitigating the issue. So that's another thing to watch out for, especially, you know, for example, if there is, you know, for a private fund advisor, if you're involved in a case with the SEC and you have to admit facts and acknowledge liability, to see the extent to which investors or others might use that settlement to bring a similar claim, a similar case, and preclude you from relitigating all of the issues and all of the facts in that particular case. So that's another thing that has yet to be decided, given that we're only living with these admissions for about 6 months. But at least the SEC's view is that the acknowledgement does not constitute a bar or preclude you from relitigating those facts going forward. So we're going to move on to some of the cases from the last year involving private funds. One of the things, and we talk about this kind of every year, we typically do not include insider trading cases in our discussion. Insider trading can be an entire discussion into itself. In past years, we've included sidebars in this conference where new developments and interesting developments have occurred. We've had sidebars on expert networks and other similar types of topics. But you will notice that there is no discussion in here of insider trading cases. To the extent there are developments in a particular year, we will discuss them. But of the vast majority of cases involving hedge funds and private funds, obviously, insider trading is that vast majority. These are the rest of the story. And the first one we're going to talk about is one that did include an admission and involved a settlement this past year of the very well-known case against... did have to admit to the facts in the case against them involving granting certain preferential terms to some strategic and core investors in order to secure their vote to restructure the funds during a period of lockup and restructuring. The loan that he obtained in order to pay his taxes and issues as to the adequacy of the disclosure of that loan to investors, and then a short squeeze that affected with respect to bonds of an issuer to the detriment of. That case was, unfortunately for everybody in this room, it was resolved through a settlement because the issues that were raised, and it was litigated up until the settlement, would have been quite interesting for us. And if any of you have the time and the inclination, the motions to dismiss and the oral arguments in that case are all publicly available and raise some very interesting issues with respect to, can you commit fraud in the context of a private fund when the fund is in lockup, when there is no purchase or sale of securities involved or possible. Securities fraud requires, under Section 10B, a material misrepresentation or omission in connection with the purchase or sale of securities. And that issue was hotly debated in the motions to dismiss and in the oral arguments before Judge Crotty in the Southern District as to whether the loan to in connection with the purchase or sale of securities when no investors could purchase or sell their interest in the fund during the time period that he obtained and then repaid that loan. The judge didn't seem to really be buying that argument. In all likelihood, that argument would have been rejected, at least on the motion to dismiss phase. But again, because of the settlement, we will not know for sure. What it does show is kind of this gravitation by the SEC from perhaps just taking Rule 20648 under the Advisors Act, which does not require in connection with. That precludes a private fund advisor from making a material misrepresentation to any investor in a private fund. And it was interesting that the SEC did not bring that case under 20648, but brought it under 10B, firm in the belief that even though the fund was in lockup, it could allege that the fraud in that case was in connection with the purchase or sale of securities. Similar issue with respect to the preferential liquidity terms to those core investors. Made the argument, which we have talked about before in this panel in past years, the fund was allowed in its documents to grant such preferential liquidity terms, and there was nothing that precluded them from doing so, and it was disclosed to investors that they could. And again, this shows the SEC's general disfavor for preferential terms, but a rather aggressive approach in that case to say that something should have been disclosed to investors in connection with the restructuring of that fund when granted preferential terms to those core investors in order to secure their vote in favor of the restructuring. So again, it gives you a sense of the SEC's view on disclosure obligations with respect to, I guess, side arrangements that are not your plain vanilla or that arise in unusual circumstance as opposed to just in connection with normal investments and redemptions from a fund. And then finally, with respect to the short squeeze, and this was one area where it did appear that the SEC was going to lose, but then secured a victory with the admission and settlement from the case pointed out there in the motion to dismiss, and Judge Crotty seemed to buy it, that there was nothing illegal about anything that did with respect to buying up all of the outstanding amount of the bonds that were at issue, entering into reverse repos to buy more than the amount that was outstanding, and then refusing to lend out those bonds in order to allow short sellers to cover their short positions. The SEC's view was that the combination of those three and the failure to disclose the combination of those three activities to amounted to a misrepresentation that rendered libel under 10B. And as the judge kept pointing out, if A is legal, B is legal, and C is legal, how can the combination of A, B, and C be illegal? And again, it appeared that the SEC was on their way to losing that argument before they reached the settlement. So, a rather interesting case, but we were deprived of perhaps the most interesting aspects of it by virtue of the settlement. There were a series of cases brought towards the end of the SEC's fiscal year involving Rule 105 under Regulation M, and I know we've talked about that quite a bit in that rule in other conferences, and most people here are most likely familiar with it. That is the rule that prohibits short selling in advance of a follow-on offering if the short seller participates in the follow-on offering and entered its short sales within typically the five-day period before the pricing of the offering. What was interesting about the cases that the SEC brought this year, or in 2013, were that they were part of this broken windows strategy that Mary Jo White and Andrew Ceresni, the director of the Division of Enforcement, have announced, which is essentially that no case is too small for them to bring, that if a small case still sends a message, if a small case still has the potential to change behavior on the street, then they will bring that case. And these cases resulted from collaboration between the SEC and FINRA to analyze short-selling activity around the dates of follow-on offerings. And the cases were brought really without any investigation other than an analysis of that data, reaching out to the firms involved and saying, we have data that indicates that you violated Rule 105. Here's what you're going to settle for. And that was it. And we handled a couple of those cases, and there was no wiggle room whatsoever. And it's very serious for, particularly for registered investment advisors and private fund advisors who have a completely clean, unblemished record, and all of a sudden you are issued what amounts to, I guess in the SEC's world, the equivalent of a parking ticket, but now it's something that is forever going to be disclosed on your form ADV and forever has to be disclosed to your investors. But the SEC really exercised zero discretion in those cases, brought them where the profits involved from the improper short selling was as little as less than $5,000 and all the way up to several million dollars. But even those funds that only had $5,000 or less in profits from their Reg M violations were forced to accept these settlements at the threat of litigation. And in fact, the SEC is currently litigating against one short seller who refused to settle, but whose profits were also minimal. And again, it reemphasizes the importance of having a robust Rule 105 compliance program within your shop, just because, again, the SEC doesn't appear to be exercising the discretion to decide which cases are so small that they shouldn't bring them. Now, apparently, no case is too small. Another significant case last year involves a little bit of the intersection of the SEC's enforcement program and examination program with respect to private funds and the shifting of the focus to private equity fund advisors. The case involved one of the highest priority issues that we've seen on the SEC's examination and enforcement agenda, which is fee shifting and shifting of expenses, rather, for private equity fund advisors. That case involved a private equity advisor who allocated to the funds expenses associated with paying salaries and office expenses that weren't in connection with management services that were provided to the portfolio companies, and it amounted to some $3 million of expenses that were shifted to the funds improperly in accordance with the provisions in the funds in the limited partnership agreements and other provisions that allowed for expenses to be borne by the funds themselves as opposed to the advisor. If any of you did not either attend or listen into or follow the CCO roundtable that the SEC gave in January of this past year, it's critical that you take a look at that if you're in the private equity space, because that outlined the various priorities that the private equity unit or the little subgroup within enforcement has with respect to private equity funds. And very briefly, they involve monitoring agreements and the SEC's concerns about the acceleration clauses in monitoring agreements when a portfolio company is sold. And the particular issue there that the SEC has, they have a fundamental problem with private equity advisors entering into 10 or 15 year long monitoring or management agreements with a portfolio company, knowing that in all likelihood they're going to dispose of that portfolio company within 5 or 6 years, yet the acceleration clause kicks in and requires the portfolio company to pay the entirety, less some discount, of the fees that would have been paid over the 10 or 15 year life of the monitoring agreement. The SEC is clearly bothered by that practice. expense shifting, as we talked about in the clean energy case, that is their biggest finding in their presence exams of private equity advisors. And it involves the similar issues to reimbursable expenses that are not set forth in the LPA. Allocation of broken deal expenses is another issue that they are looking closely at. It's pretty easy when you have a consummated deal and the funds that participate then share in those expenses and bear those expenses. But when you have a broken deal, how are you allocating the expenses to the funds that probably would have or potentially would have participated in that deal? They're looking at expenses that are paid to related service providers, consulting agreements, senior advisors. Are you shifting expenses that you would have borne yourself to pay salaries to employees and calling senior advisors and other affiliated persons consultants that can then be paid for by the funds, and any other outsourcing to related parties? Those are hot topics for the SEC currently in the areas of private equity advisors. So as more private funds move into the private equity space, or as the SEC's enforcement and exam program emphasizes or puts more emphasis on private equity advisors, those are the issues that they're really paying attention to. And again, if you haven't listened into it or seen the presentation materials from the CCO outreach in January, it's critical that you do so if you're in the private equity space. It gives some terrific insights there.
Mary Jo?
Okay. So first we wanted to touch on actions that the SEC has brought against investment advisors or persons associated with them for allegedly making misleading statements to both existing and prospective investors. And the two cases that I just wanted to mention are one in the matter of in which the firm was charged, along with one of the individuals at the firm, with misleading investors relating to the firm's ability to conduct algorithmic currency trading. And the specific motivation for the misleading statements was in order to become approved to manage the investors' funds. And so this was an important case and one that is worth taking a read at. The next one is the matter. This related to the use of a parking arrangement with middlemen, in effect, to sell property between two funds in violation of the ERISA laws and in violation of the operating agreement between and its clients. Again, it was framed up by the SEC as fraudulent conduct and charged, and one that you might want to take a look at.
Sorry, yeah, just on that one again, this is another series, and we've highlighted some of these cases again in the past. This wasn't exactly a cross trade, but it was kind of like a cross trade, and the SEC's skepticism regarding any cross trades between particular funds for a reason other than your typical rebalancing or something else that might warrant cross trading between your funds. But the SEC has brought a number of cases over the last few years, being just the latest one involving allegations around fraud in connection with cross-trading or trades between one fund and another.
So. Well, that's a really important point, and we could also share that it continues to be a priority of the examination program, and we are counseling more than one client now where the SEC is really probing and asking questions about so-called cross trades and the legitimacy of them. And it's an area that I think they are going to continue to be looking very closely at. The last two areas that I just want to touch on is the case. This was a standard case alleging that they had omitted information from their advertisements, therefore claiming a misleading performance level. This case arose out of a very specific initiative that the SEC brought and used to ultimately get to the cases that were brought. It was called the Aberrational Performance Initiative. It was run out of the Asset Management Unit, which is a specialty unit within the Division of Enforcement, which focuses and specializes particularly on conduct of advisors and funds. And in working together with the SEC's division, it's called DERA, the Division of Economic Risk Analysis, they conceived of a thesis, and I'm telling you this because they're doing this more and more, and you should be aware of the increased capability that the SEC has with regard to the use of. So they conceived of a thesis as to try to build out models and worked with quants and economists to look at series or groups of advisors and what types of clients they had or what types of investment strategies they were using and what they would predict that their appropriate performance numbers would be. And then they through data, looked to find those which appeared to be outliers. And then they sliced the data again, and then they sliced the data again until they whittled it down to a fairly small number, and then they sent examiners out into the field to walk into these shops and examine their books and records to determine whether, in fact, there was some other reason that was not apparent from the way the data had been analyzed to explain the performance or not. And out of that initiative over time came a handful of cases. It's ongoing, there will be others, and this was one of them. The last one that I will touch upon is the case against the... This was really a cherry-picking scheme where they engaged in a number of trades. Well, they didn't designate or distinguish up front which trades were being made for clients and which were for their own personal accounts. They would wait several days and then they would allocate profitable trades to their personal accounts and the non-profitable trades to client accounts. And this, again, was another one that was brought. It was brought out of the Chicago office of the SEC. I have seen some collateral private litigation on the heels of this, where individual clients have brought actions in state court, not only against their firm, but also against the trust holding company at the bank who had custody of the assets. This is another one that, first of all, is interesting to take a look at, and second of all, although the case was not initiated as the result of, it was actually opened on a completely different issue, and the issues that they ultimately were charged with resulted from the use of an analytical trading tool that allowed them to really analyze the trading over a significant period of time and see the patterns that resulted in the case. Thank you.
Thank you.
To listen to other panels from the 2014 7th Annual Advanced Topics in Hedge Fund Practices Conference, visit Podcast Central at morganlewis.com. If you have any questions or would like more information on the topics addressed in this podcast, please contact a Morgan Lewis attorney at morganlewis.com. This podcast is provided as a general informational service to clients and friends of Morgan Lewis & Bockius, LLP. It should not be construed as and does not constitute legal advice on any specific matter, nor does this message create an attorney-client relationship. These materials may be considered attorney advertising in some states. Please note that any prior results discussed in the material do not guarantee similar outcomes. Read more about Morgan Lewis and its hedge funds practice at morganlewis.com/hedgefundsresources.